As the father of a current ASU student, as a graduate of ASU myself, and as chairman of the Cronkite Schools Endowment Board, I have a unique perspective about the local, national, and global impact of this university. Therefore, it's a great honor to introduce the man who is leading the charge at a pace and energy level that is something to behold. Dr. Michael M. Crow is the 16th president of Arizona State University. Dr. Crow is guiding the transformation of ASU into one of the nation's leading public metropolitan research universities, one that is directly engaged in the economic, social, and cultural vitality of the region. Under his direction, the university pursues teaching, research, and creative excellence focused on the major challenges and questions of our time, as well as those central to the building of a sustainable environment and economy for Arizona. He has committed the university to global engagement and to setting a new standard for public service. He's also been a strong advocate of the Cronkite School, and we couldn't be more appreciative of his support. Please join me in welcoming to the stage Dr. Michael M. Crow.
Thank you for that introduction, and thank you to all of you for being here today. It's my pleasure today to have the opportunity to introduce our dean, Chris Callahan, but I want to put Chris Callahan and the Cronkite School of Journalism into perspective. All of you know that we live in a period of such rapid and dynamic political change, social change, technological change, economic change, and even within the world of journalism, information and knowledge change that we don't even have a name for it yet. I don't even know what to call it. All I know is that in this moment of change, what we've seen is abandonment of many of the core ideas and principles on which our country was built and on which we were successful. And those go back to the notion of journalists acting as the seekers of truth, the seekers of the story, the seekers of what is actually going on, as opposed to what now seems to sort of fly under the flag of journalism, which is a lot of entertainment and a lot of opinion and a lot of theater. And so moving away from the notion of theater and entertainment and whatever other people are referring to as news these days and focusing on what our country really needs, we set out a few years ago to rethink and reconceptualize the centrality and the importance of journalism as an academic field, the centrality and importance of journalists and their training, the centrality and the importance of producing a new generation empowered by new technology, empowered by new methods, empowered by new pedagogy, empowered by new ways of doing things. And so we set out first to pull our journalism school away from being buried inside a bunch of other academic units, to create it as a standalone college. The second step that we took was to go out and find a national leader, that would be Chris Callahan, who had the courage and the guts and the wisdom and the talent and the drive to make things happen and to advance journalism under a new kind of flag, which is an all-platform, all-technology, all-empowerment kind of flag. And Chris has been able to do that. And then third, once Chris was here and we were able to move things forward, we were able to put together between public and private sources, between the people of the city of Phoenix, the university itself, foundations, philanthropists, and others, over $100 million to launch this new enterprise, now done, built, and under construction. And why are we doing this? We're doing this because if we don't get the storytelling right, and we don't get news right, and we don't make these things happen, our democracy does not work. It's as simple as that. And so our leader in making these things happen has done a fantastic job of attracting great faculty, building great alliances, and most importantly, driving the level of journalistic education in our students to the highest possible level and doing all of this at scale. All of this at scale. We're not talking about 10 students or 20 students. We're talking about 1,000 students. And then people say, how could you launch something that has 1,000 students? There's no jobs. What do you mean there's no jobs? The stories always have to be told. They have to be told by the people that know how to tell them. And that's why we built this school at this scale. That's why we have Chris Callahan. Chris Callahan, our dean. Welcome.
Thank you, President Crow. President Crow left out one important element on the success of this school for 5 years, and I would argue the most important element, and that is having a university president who understands journalism education, who treasures journalism education, and is passionate about journalism education and the future of our field. I can tell you I've been in the Academy for many years now. That is rare indeed. President Crow, thank you for everything that you've done on behalf of the Cronkite School. The Cronkite Award luncheon is always a very special day in the Valley, certainly a special day for the Cronkite School. But today really is extra special. First and foremost, because of our Cronkite Award recipient, Diane Sawyer. What an absolute thrill it is to have you here today. Thank you. Thank you for being here. In addition to having such a preeminent journalist as Diane with us, what I am really struck by is how Diane has approached the last few days. And she has really made this award about the students of the Cronkite School. And I'm just going to tell you a little bit about the last 24 hours and the next 24 hours. Diane flew in yesterday afternoon, I guess it was, after a very long day in New York, did the world news from the Cronkite School, from the top of the Cronkite School, which is, of course, fantastic national exposure for our students and our school. Then, what you may not know, is she took a group of students from our ABC News on Campus program out for pizza at Pizzeria Bianco. And she did that before coming back to the Biltmore to have a lovely dinner with some special friends of the Cronkite School. If that wasn't enough, this morning, Diane woke up early to go back to the Cronkite School to meet with many, many of our students who couldn't be with us today. And I can tell you that an 8:30 event on a Friday is roughly 4 to 5 hours before most of our students usually get up. I'm thrilled to say and not surprised that it was a packed house and even started early and went late, so that's just fantastic. Diane had to rush back here for our reception and luncheon. Right after this, she's going back to the Cronkite School, where she will anchor world news again from the top of the Cronkite School before flying out for a reporting trip to China. That shows a level of dedication and spirit to our students that we are just enormously appreciative of. Diane's approach to this honor is also going to be seen in a few minutes. As many of you who have been to many Cronkite luncheons know, that typically after the recipient receives the award, they will come to the podium and give a speech about journalism. And that's been fantastic. But Diane didn't want to do that. She wanted to have our students more directly involved. So instead of that, what you're going to see in a few minutes is two of our great Cronkite School seniors come up, sit with Diane, and do an interview. And I think that really says so much about her passion for these students and the future of journalism. I'd like to take a moment to recognize a few special groups, and of course I'll start off with our students. Once again, they proved this year that they are the very best journalism students in the country. They took first place in the Society of Professional Journalists Mark of Excellence Award for the fifth consecutive year, and over the last 5 years have been number one in the Hearst Journalism Awards. Will the students of the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism and Mass Communication please stand up so we can recognize you? And of course, our wonderful alumni. We are 7,000 plus alumni strong across the country and across the world. Many of them are with us today, including our new National Advisory Board of Alumni, headed by Craig Newman, and Don Dotts, class of 1957, who is this year's ASU Distinguished Alumni Service Award recipients. Will the alumni of the Cronkite School please stand up so we can salute you? And finally, I'd like to recognize a very special friend who, unfortunately, will be leaving us in a few months. Janice Todd has been the general manager of ABC 15 for just about as long as I've been dean here at the Cronkite School. And I can tell you the Cronkite School has never had a better, more passionate, more dedicated friend. Through her work on the Cronkite Endowment Board, and she led all of our efforts on high school recruitment and diversity, through her work with the ABC News on Campus program, to having our student work displayed on newscasts on ABC 15, to helping arrange for Diane and the ABC News team to come to town. Janice has been an absolutely wonderful supporter of the Cronkite School, and I wanted to take this moment to publicly thank her for everything that she's done. At this point, I'd like to welcome my friend John Meisner back to the podium, and John will have the honor of introducing Diane Sawyer. John?
It is now my great honor to turn everyone's attention to the 27th recipient of the Walter Cronkite Award for Excellence in Journalism, Ms. Diane Sawyer. A native of Glasgow, Kentucky, and raised in Lowville, Ms. Sawyer received a BA from Wellesley College and completed a semester of law school before embarking on a career in broadcasting. Ms. Sawyer was part of the Nixon-Ford transition team from 1974 to 1975 and assisted former President Nixon in the writing of his memoirs in 1974 and 75. She began her career in broadcasting in 1967 in Lowville, where she was a reporter for WLKY-TV until 1970. Prior to joining ABC News, Ms. Sawyer spent 9 years at CBS. There she made history as the first female correspondent of 60 Minutes. She also co-anchored the CBS Morning News and was CBS News' State Department correspondent. While at CBS, Ms. Sawyer covered the 1980, 1984, and 1988 national conventions as a floor and then a podium correspondent. Today, as you know, Diane is anchor of ABC's flagship broadcast, World News. She is also the network's principal anchor for breaking news, election coverage, and special events. Ms. Sawyer joined ABC in February 1989 as co-anchor of Prime Time. In addition to that role, she was named co-anchor of Good Morning America in January 1999 and held the post until taking over the World News anchor chair in December of 2009. In August 2009, GMA was recognized with its third consecutive Emmy Award for Outstanding Morning Program. Ms. Sawyer is one of the most respected journalists in the world. She has traveled the globe delivering in-depth and breaking news reports and has conducted interviews with almost every major newsmaker of our time. Her primetime documentaries have won critical acclaim for shedding light on difficult and previously underreported topics. During the historic 2008 presidential election, Ms. Sawyer co-anchored ABC News coverage of the political conventions, election night, and the inauguration. Over the course of the campaign, she conducted wide-ranging interviews with the candidates and also reported Portrait of a President, two-hour-long specials that revealed new insight into Barack Obama, John McCain, and their families. In June 2009, along with Charles Gibson, Ms. Sawyer moderated Questions for the President, Prescription for America, a conversation with President Obama about health care reform at the White House. Through her distinguished documentary work, Ms. Sawyer has tackled challenging issues in prime time. In 2006, her report on the crises in the foster care system was recognized with the Robert F. Kennedy Journalism Award. In January 2007, Ms. Sawyer delivered an eye-opening report on poverty in America, Waiting on the World to Change, which gave viewers insight in the lives of families in Camden, New Jersey, the poorest city in America. Ms. Sawyer and her team of producers spent 2 years in the hills of Appalachia reporting the February 2009 special, A Hidden America, Children of the Mountains. Ms. Sawyer's other primetime documentaries include an investigation into the warehousing of Russian children in state-run orphanages, a diary of life inside a women's maximum security prison where she spent 2 days and nights with inmates, an investigation into the neglect and abuse at state-run institutions for the mentally retarded, and a landmark investigation into pharmacy prescription errors. In October 2006, Ms. Sawyer traveled to North Korea and brought viewers an unprecedented look into that secretive country. The first American journalist to ever report live from North Korea, Ms. Sawyer also anchored North Korea Inside the Shadows, an hour-long primetime special that included interviews with key government and military officials and new information on what life is like for North Koreans. In February of 2007, Ms. Sawyer traveled to Syria and Iran, where she conducted exclusive interviews with Syrian President Bashar al-Assad and Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. In April 2008, Ms. Sawyer co-anchored Good Morning America from Afghanistan and Saudi Arabia. Ms. Sawyer also reported from Southeast Asia in the wake of the deadly 2005 tsunami from Moscow, where she made her way into the office of Boris Yeltsin at the pinnacle of the Soviet coup, from Egypt during the Gulf War, where she interviewed President Hosni Mubarak, and Amman, Jordan, where she interviewed King Hussein and Queen Noor. During the Iraq War, she conducted an exclusive interview with one of the main architects of Saddam Hussein's biological weapons program, Dr. Raheeb Taha, nicknamed Dr. Germ. Domestically, Ms. Sawyer reported from New Orleans on the devastating aftermath of Hurricane Katrina in the fall of 2005. She also conducted a live exclusive interview with President George W. Bush in the midst of widespread criticism of his administration's handling of the storm. On September 11, 2001, Ms. Sawyer, along with Charles Gibson, began the network's award-winning coverage of the attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. In the days that followed, Ms. Sawyer reported live from Ground Zero and later interviewed more than 60 widows who gave birth after the World Trade Center disaster. Ms. Sawyer's reporting has been recognized with numerous awards, including DuPonts, Emmys, Peabody's, the grand prize of the Premier Investigative Reporters and Editors Association, an IRTS Lifetime Achievement Award, and the USC Distinguished Achievement in Journalism Award. In 1997, she was inducted into the Television Academy Hall of Fame. This video tribute will give you an even greater sense of Diane's accomplishments. It was produced by the Cronkite School's Jim Dove, Melanie Alvarez, and Jim Jacoby. Let's take a look.
Diane Sawyer sitting in the evening news chair is sort of a perfect fit.
You can't get any more authentic than Diane Sawyer. She is an old school journalist in the very best of ways.
At every step in her career, she has changed the equation. She did it at CBS with 60 Minutes. She came back to Good Morning America and stayed and likely saved that program. And I think, again, at World News, that she's setting the pace for everyone else.
Good evening from Phoenix, Arizona, on this Veterans Day, and it is beautiful here. We have come here to meet with students at the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism. But at the top of the news,
first and foremost responsibility every day is to tell things like they are, to really give the viewer a sense of what's happening in any one location, on any given story, on any night.
3 days, I ask again. 3 days without anything, they responded.
That was the case in Haiti. It was the case in Afghanistan. She really wants to give people an experience.
Is it tough?
A lot of people ask, where does that connection come from that Diane has? I mean, she's Diane Sawyer. But at the same time, she's the girl from Kentucky. And I don't think that that has ever gone away.
We take you tonight to one of the poorest regions in the nation, where men and women die younger than other Americans, where there's a documented epidemic of drug addiction, cancer, toothlessness, alcoholism, depression.
I won't forget the story she did on Appalachia, returning home to the mountains to do the stories of the families and the sort of economic turmoil they were facing. There was this one little boy, 11 years old, who had never been to the dentist before, and he couldn't brush his teeth because his mouth hurt so much. I'll never forget the moment after the dentist starts working on the boy.
Will you send me a picture? I want to see this new smile.
And she means that. And those are the moments where you see that, you know, this is really the girl from Kentucky who's never forgotten where she's come from, never forgotten that there are people all over this country who have stories that need to be told.
The six Americans who escaped from Iran this past weekend spent their first full day back in the United States today, reunited with their families. Diane Sawyer reports.
Dawn on a welcome day for Linda Anders.
There's so much that I want to talk to you about. I'm just going to plunge right on in.
Well, my feeling is that history is going to treat my presidency perhaps considerably more objectively.
What she does is very instructive of how we should continue to strive for journalistic excellence.
She sort of pushes us to be better interviewers, to be more probing when we're out there, no matter who we're talking to, no matter what side they're on.
Instead of retiring, Sister Emmanuelle says she got down on her knees and asked God to send her to serve in the most wretched place on earth,
all because she had a theory that you can change people's lives if you first affirm their lives by living as they do.
There's this great poster that she still keeps sort of in the corner of her office, but I always get a kick out of it when I read it. And it's from her early days on 60 Minutes. And it says, to be on a team like this, you have to be good. And then it simply says, she is.
I can't think of many people, if any, who get straight A's in all the different forms of journalism, except Diane Sawyer. She can do an in-depth interview with the president on economic policy and whip up a souffle at 7 a.m. She can do an hour report on a sick child with empathy and do an undercover investigation on racism with cold-eyed balance. She can be clear and concise and poetically lyrical. She can be smart and penetrating and facetious and funny. She can read the news with authority and be warm and caring in a tragedy. No wonder she's getting such a prestigious award in Walter Cronkite's name. Congratulations, Diane.
I think what's fascinating to all of us is that Diane can run circles around us all.
I remember sitting in Afghanistan with her while we were there on a four-day trip, having spent all day and night with the U.S. troops out on the streets talking to the Afghan people and hearing about the earthquake in Haiti, and spending the next 12 hours trying desperately to be able to get there as fast as possible.
More bodies in the heat.
But once she was there, the connection that she had to the people there and the caring that she had from giving up her water and trying to make sure that the world heard those people's stories was something that is incredibly powerful.
Probably the most memorable trip was going to North Korea with Diane. We went in October of 2006, just a few days after they had tested a nuclear device. They were constantly resisting us on doing anything spontaneous. Everything has to be planned. Everything has a schedule. And finally, just one morning, she just basically announced at breakfast to all of our government minders and to us, saying, you know, I just want to go, you know, walk down the river and talk to people as they're going to work. Before you know it, she's standing there stopping North Koreans on their way to work and asking them questions about what do they think about America.
The wonderful thing about Diane is how much of a team player she is internally.
She's a reporter every day when she comes in to this building. And she's, if not asking questions on the air, she's asking them of all of us behind the scenes about the stories that we're working on.
She's marvelous in that way and really a terrific anchor in the true sense of the word.
And I think that will be her legacy, is that she has made the rest of us so much better.
And just like our famous train trip along the railways of America, every day here has been a grateful journey forward with the GMA family around me.
This is the beauty of Diane. You know all the awards, accolades. They go on and on and on. And I often say, and I mean it, it has been and continues to be a privilege to work with an icon, to work with, I'm sorry, Diane, a living legend, and she is. But what you don't know is what's behind the scenes. When I was diagnosed with breast cancer in 2007, Diane was relentless. I remember distinctly one night, she knew that I couldn't sleep. So she calls me, and she said, I'll take it from here.
Beloved Robin showed us all how you hold on when the news is tough.
And it's now been able to say it out loud. I have breast cancer. Like you said, onward.
And then how you take it on.
And I'll never forget her being by my side, literally and figuratively. And that's my Thelma.
I don't know why they fired you, but I want you to know that I'm never, ever going to watch Good Morning America again, and I hate everyone there now. And good luck with the new game show. It's going to be okay.
I hope that Diane is not the last in a series of excellent journalists.
Are you sending Iranian weapons into Iraq?
Hopefully what she stands for will prevail.
Her passion really is to take what's happening every day that is glossed over by all of us and put it in your face and make you pay attention and make you make a difference.
I think all you could do is say to them, there was a time when one person could say, that's the way it is.
And that's the way it is.
That's the way it is. And that's the way it is.
And we all trusted it was true.
I think for the students at the Cronkite School and for the audience at home, it's not something you can fake. She lives it and she breathes it and she makes us all better every day.
We'll see you again tomorrow night from out west. Until then, good night.
President Michael Crowe will now present the Walter Cronkite Award for Excellence in Journalism to Diane Sawyer. At this time, Cronkite School students Kylie Gauna and Sierra Lambrecht will interview Walter Cronkite's Award for Excellence in Journalism recipient, Diane Sawyer. Kylie Gauna is a Cronkite School senior from Yuma, Arizona. She is an anchor and reporter for Cronkite Newswatch, the school's award-winning 30-minute newscast produced by Cronkite School students. She also was involved in ASU's Devil's Advocates, Kappa Alpha Theta Sorority, and the Leadership Scholarship Program. Sierra Lambrecht is a Cronkite School senior from Scottsdale. She is the host of Sun Levels 101, a student-produced magazine-style show about ASU athletics and student-athletes, which airs on Fox Sports Arizona. Sierra also is a sports anchor for Cronkite Newswatch and contributes to its Spanish-language programming. Some of her news stories have appeared nationally on Telemundo. Ladies and gentlemen, Kylie Gauna, Sierra Lambrecht, and Diane Sawyer.
Well, I have to say again, congratulations, Diane.
Thank you.
You've inspired so many of us here in the room today, and you've touched people's lives all around the world. So, on behalf of Kylie and myself, we are truly honored and humbled to be sitting on the stage with you.
Well, what a beautiful thing to say, and I want to thank everyone who worked on that tape. It's, and I'm still alive. Wow! It was so moving, and to everyone who participated in it, I thank you. I've had a great morning at the school. I love the school, as I said to everybody there. The only thing is we're all going to go home so depressed because you have such beautiful newsrooms. You have such incredible facilities, and there's such great vitality there. It is the future, and it's the beating heart of the future. And I got to see it this morning, so it was great.
I know, Kylie and I both cried at the video, and that was only the rough cut.
Yeah, so we were like crying backstage, so hopefully, you know, we don't shed any tears right now.
Well, I took my coat off because I'm expecting this inquisition. Getting ready.
Well, we've already touched on so many of your career highlights, but from being an aide to former President Nixon, working on 60 Minutes, what has been your biggest career highlight?
Oh, you know, I can't think of one part of it. It's, to me, it's been the whole journey and the chance to do so many diverse things. And as Leslie said, I got to cook in the morning, which was not very credible, let me tell you, but I cooked nonetheless in the morning. And then I got to travel off and interview Saddam Hussein and ask the questions I wanted to ask. At the end of the day, don't you feel, though, it's always when you tumble into someone's life, an unexpected
encounter, and you're out of doing a story. I remember in Camden, a little boy, we did a story on a little boy who didn't have enough to eat. In fact, he didn't even know that you were supposed to have three meals a day. When I asked him about breakfast, lunch, and dinner, he did not know what I was talking about. And little Ivan is doing wonderfully today. Thank you to the generosity of everyone who watched. But I just remember leaving the story, and one of the little kids turned to me and said, "Thank you. Be blessed and have a better one tomorrow." And this is from the heart of wretched poverty in America. And those are the words that etch themselves right in your heart when you go out to do it. So it's all the people we get to meet who make us see and believe in the possibilities of the world.
No, that's very true, and I feel like obviously you've touched a lot of people's lives along the way. So let's go back then. Let's go back to your Nixon years.
Let's go back to some of those hairstyles and redo them. Oh,
I'm
my
sure
gosh.
You might have had a, you know, you might not have had this do back then. 1970s, right? Just kidding. So you were press aide from 1970 until his resignation in 1974.
Right.
How is it like to work in the White House during that time and really watch history unfold before your very eyes?
Well, you know, I came there a complete, bewildered kind of innocent walking up the door. Could not believe that my office was in the White House. And you can still see the window. I go visit it periodically just to see who's in there now and what they're thinking. I was saying earlier this morning, though, the main thing you learn is that it's a group of people making decisions, and the things that we think are the result of infinite meetings and three-dimensional strategies are just somebody who didn't feel very good that day and decided to do it that way. And so it does remind you that sometimes when you look at the president and you think it means something, he's just tired. Or sometimes when you see something that seems to have been a calculated aggressive move, somebody just made a mistake. They didn't mean to do it that way. So I think it brings a lot of humanity straight to the coverage of the White House to see it that way. I also believe, and I went there because I had started in journalism. I started as a weather girl, as I told everyone this morning. So terrible that I couldn't even see the west coast
pretty well.
Of the map. Yeah, I couldn't see the map because I didn't have glasses or contacts that I wore on the air. So I was just kind of improvising what the map was like. And I was assigned my first story. I still think he was secretly the Marquis de Sade, my first news director who's beloved in my heart. But he assigned me as my very first story to cover a five-mile hike in a place called Red River Gorge with the then Justice Douglas, who was a big environmentalist. My very first story, and I just remember that I dressed very coordinated, because I thought that was very important, and I had tapes, and I had tape recorders, and I had pencils, and I had pens, and I had my own camera, and I was taking the camera, and I did the thing you see in the cartoons, and I said, "You stay there, and I'm going to back up and get the," they have still someplace in the archives the justice disappearing as I'm going feet first down into Red River Gorge, and he actually leans over the gorge and says, "Are you new at this, dear?" as I'm plummeting. So I left journalism, not because of that, but because I really wanted to see what it was like to be on the other side. It's one thing to wake up every day questioning power. I wanted to see what it was like when you were inside. And the main lesson I learned was it's a group of human beings who are working hard, and that sometimes we have to remember, all of us together on all political sides, that we are in this together, and that we are a community. We are one nation, one great nation. And if we just show respect, we can move forward together.
So you fell off a cliff.
I did.
I wish we would have had that for the video.
Yeah. I'll reenact it for you.
Was there, you know, maybe after that day, or was there any other time down the road when you were ready to throw in the towel and call it quits?
Mm-hmm. Oh, I think you can't be working in something you absolutely love and care about and not think periodically, I can't do this. You know, I can't get up. I'm going to China tonight. How I'm going to look getting off that plane is going to be spectacularly horrible. We're going to be so tired. We are going to get there, and suddenly, I know what's going to happen. It's as if we have a B12 shot, because we have so many questions we want to ask. Here we are, heading to a country. This fact astounds me. Where more people speak English than there are people in the United States. We are heading to a country about 4.5 times the size of the United States. We are heading to a country that has set very clear goals with the mission of becoming the country of the 21st century. And we know that America can roar back. And we're there to learn what they're doing in education. What does a 2-year-old know in China that a 2-year-old here should know? And we want to report back, and we'll be filled with such excitement. You know, I think we're all bred for curiosity. That's what's in our DNA as journalists. We just wake up in the morning wanting to know things. And I remember Edward R. Murrow saying, which I still think is just a perfectly easy definition of what we do at our best, we're supposed to tell the truth and not get too big for our britches. And that's what we should set out to do. There are parts of it along the way, as I said this morning. The being on television part, to me, the hair and makeup part, all of that, is not what I think about, but it's always opening that folder and thinking, oh, gotta answer this question, gotta answer it.
So when you're going to China, and I'm sure you're going to be talking with lots of people there.
Yeah.
And you've talked to a few people in your years as a journalist. So from, you know, Madonna to Fidel Castro, what has been your best interview, you think, and what's been the worst interview over the last 40 years? You've probably been asked that question a time or two, too.
You know, I don't think I can come up with a best interview. I can't do that.
There's just so many, right?
Yes. I'm a Methodist Calvinist child, and we don't allow ourselves to think that way. But I do think that, as I said this morning, the interview with Saddam Hussein was the trickiest, because you have to calculate the questions you want to ask. How many people did you kill? Why do you put people in jail? Why do you put people in jail in your country if they disagree with you? And you know what he said to me? I swear, he said, well, that's what you do in your country. And I thought, oh my goodness, his kind of dictatorship is built on never being told the truth about the world. Mm-hmm. He actually didn't know. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, Mr. President, we give them their own talk show on TV if they criticize the president in America. And he went and looked around at his aides. He did not know. So getting out with our people safe, getting out with the tapes, and asking the toughest questions I could think of, that was probably the tricky. The worst, over the years. You always come back and say, oh, why didn't I ask that? I should have asked that. I said earlier, in Good Morning America, you interview a lot of actors and celebrities, and those are often hard because you want to make them mean something, too, and sometimes it's just too early. And by and large, actors don't tend to get up that early in the morning, so those could be hard. There was an interview with a guy, Joaquin Phoenix, at one point, and it was just going terribly, and he didn't have anything to say, and he just got up and came and sat on my lap. It happens at morning television.
So what challenges do you think you face today that maybe Walter Cronkite didn't face when he was on the news desk?
Well, I loved President Crowe's mission statement. And we all know that things are changing. And when we think we've deciphered the change, it's just changed again. Mm-hmm. And that we are hearing so much noise and at the expense, we often think, of real information, that it's going to be a challenge for all of us to do it. And simply to get enough factual information out there to have a coherent democracy, as he said. I remember reading the other day, I don't know if this is still true, that 12% of people interviewed in America thought Joan of Arc was Noah's wife. No kidding. It's a poll. It's a real poll out there. And we often see it on late-night comedy. We see it on late-night television, going out in the street and polling people and what they know and don't know. But I think that our job, truly, far more than it is to navigate all of the different pathways, is to have something to say when we're navigating. And it's one thing to have people along the political spectrum who are bringing a lot of admittedly partisan ideas to the table. And I don't think we should be afraid of ideas. Ideas and ideas argued cogently are how democracy works. But we have to bring an equal passion to facts, to seeing things whole, seeing things clear. We have to make it exciting to hear what we have to say because we believe it is the truth. And when we don't believe it's the truth, we believe the question is important. I loved, there was a Manhattan Project scientist once, I.I. Rabi, who said when he got home from school every day, his father asked one question. Did you ask any good questions today? Our job is to keep journalism alive with burning questions, with questions at the center of what matters to our lives, and answer them as best we can. And that's always the challenge. I love the changing media world. Mm-hmm. I love when we have to scramble and think in a new way and wake each other up and imagine all the different sources of information people are obtaining. But at the center of it is still, what are we saying, and do we believe in it with all of the passion that the people on either side of political spectrums do?
So, you know, you're talking about how, obviously, journalism and the industry has changed over the last 40 years. And, you know, you obviously are a big journalism vet, and you've seen a lot of changes. But you're a big proponent of social media and all these new kind of innovative ways. How have you been able to kind of tackle these, you know, social media issues head on? And why do you think it's important for journalists today to use social media and other kind of tools to help kind of advance the story and give others a voice?
Because inside the story, there are so many different ways of telling it. Mm-hmm. And each one is a way of exploding our sense of what the world is. You can, in a tweet, focus attention with a pinprick mm-hmm. on something you want to tell people. You can, in an hour-long documentary on television, still take them to Appalachia for an entire hour, and they'll come to watch and stay with you to learn about kids. As you saw, there is so much toothlessness there. It is an epidemic of kids growing up without teeth. And we examine the Mountain Dew problem and the acidity in Mountain Dew and the sugar in Mountain Dew. And afterwards, I went to Pepsi and said, okay, what do we do here? And Pepsi gave a dental van to travel up in the hills, which is a start to go to schools. There, as we showed everyone, babies in their bottles are given Mountain Dew. And it's not, you know, it's not that they don't love their kids. It's just part of life. And we forget that you can still grow up in America with all the television coverage and still have an insulated enough community that you're simply not educated to the consequences of what you're doing. So that each of these, somebody told me once, don't, when you're faced with something tough, and you have writer's block, or you just don't want to address it during that day, just remember, it's not the story, it's a story. And each of these social media events is a story. It's all part of the great kaleidoscope. And the more we can get out, the more we can be known for talking to people in the language they speak, the better we're all going to be, and the wider our reach is going to be. especially to kids. And I've told this story before because it's such a cautionary tale to me about kids in general, and myself mainly, but I am running through Central Park, which in my view is shuffling, really. I mean, I have to confess, I think I run, I barely do. And these kids are there with their dad, and they send him over, and he comes up to me, and he said, one picture, and then they're going like this, oh, we can't believe it, can't believe it. And I went over, and I got in the middle of them, and I posed like this, and they said, no, we wanted you to take the picture of us. And I just want all of you to think how you would extract yourself from that inexplicable. I said, I like to hug people before I take their picture, so I'll hug each of you, and then I'll take the picture. And then I ran, hoping they would think I was Martha Stewart if they ever heard about it. So we have to reach people in a new way.
We definitely wanted a picture with you.
Yeah. Okay,
so
thank you very
much.
We're
glad you put our arms around you.
Thank you.
So with building that rapport with whoever you may be interviewing, mm-hmm. Walter Cronkite was said to be one of the most trusted man in America.
Yes.
So how do you think you've applied that in your own career?
You know, what he did cannot be replicated because he expressed something in every part of being Walter, which was so much of the history of our country at that time. From Vietnam to the space program, he had been there in a way that we know today. It's not the audience that has watched with the same arc of commonality that you had when you had three networks. But what he did most of all personally for me, and again, I said this morning, I was scared to death of Walter Cronkite. I could not believe I was there. I had worked in the White House and they had a phone. They had an actual red phone that rang, and when it rang, it was the president. And I walked in and a phone rang and someone said, "It's Walter." And I went, oh, because I couldn't believe I was getting to work with him. I was in awe of him and so afraid I would disappoint him. So afraid I would. And what he brought was the ballast of humor. And all of you who knew him, all of you who knew who he really was, know that he brought a love of the fullness of life. It wasn't some stern lecture about journalism. It was, hey, what do you know? What do you know today? What do you know that's new today? And the thing I hope I take most from him, truly, is the sense that we do have to keep reinforcing the whole country, not just the six grim stories that appear all the time, but to remind ourselves we're looking in a mirror. And in the mirror is the whole of who we are. And yes, there are tough times, and we all have been covering the foreclosure problems in Arizona and unemployment here and across the country. And we do have to do that, but we also have to keep telling everyone what resilience is about. And that if you look in the mirror, we're also those resilient people, and we will rise to this occasion. And that's who he was. Whatever has happened, he stood for, we are together, we will do it together, and tomorrow we will rise to what's needed. I have to say, when I saw on the tape him introducing me for a minute, I started pounding again.
So you worked at CBS, you worked at 60 Minutes, and you were the first ever, female correspondent. You've, advanced, obviously very far in a career that was typically in the beginning dominated by men. And now you are a network news anchor. I mean, you've really reached the pinnacle in your career. So how has it been being a female journalist, and how has that evolved over the last 40 years in which you've been in the business?
Well, and first of all, it's so great that Katie is there too. And I just love the fact that we can look up any night, and there are two women anchoring the evening news broadcast. It's not remarkable anymore. That's always the best phrase. And my dream would be for all the women who want to get in this business that when you talk about a woman is doing that story, everybody goes, yeah, so, huh, huh? That's what the dream always is. Most of all, and I was saying earlier today, I had to do a panel, and we talked about this last night, but I had to do a panel about women at Sun Valley for a group of corporate executives, and the wonderful chart to deliver, of course, is that you can track on the chart. Catalyst has the chart, and you can track the number of women in key positions and earnings. And they have a curious parallel. So there's an absolute bottom line for bringing women at high levels into companies. But when I called Jack Welch, because I said to him, what's the thing you've learned, the most important thing you've learned about women in the workplace? And he said, it's not having confidence exercises, and it's not all of the things that we think it is. It's just numbers. Get the numbers in. Get the right number in the room so that women are there, fully present, fully themselves, fully equal, and it takes care of everything. So the thing that I most treasure, in a way, in looking at the arc of being a female in the workplace is looking around our newsroom and the number of women producers. We don't even think about it. John Banner is here, but the majority. You go to cover a story, Afghanistan, where Iraq, no matter where we are in war zones, women are there covering the story. I love that it's no longer remarkable. It's just wonderful.
So at Cronkite, we're learning how to be multimedia journalists, mm-hmm. one-man bands. Mm-hmm. And that's becoming a trend mm-hmm. nowadays. What do you think about the MMJ, or one-man band? How do you think it's affecting journalism?
Well, I was the one-man band who fell down Red River Gorge, so I probably shouldn't be trusted with all that anymore. But, I think that there's different stories require different approaches. I think one-man band is great for a huge percentage of the stories we cover. I also believe investigative work, being one of them, that that's where hearing someone else challenge you, hearing someone else question you, you're out there, you're in the middle of an interview, you think you got it, you think you have penetrated, and someone comes to you, as they did to me the other day, and said, you missed this, go back and do it again. And two people, three people make a big difference in covering stories and testing them and making sure that you're being fair always, because part of being an investigative reporter is believing that you've got to do the story because this story is important. You also need people there saying, are you right about this? Have you double-checked that? Have you triple-checked that? So it seems to me it's a world in which we can have both kinds of journalism. And we all know, we looked up and saw 80 people covering the same shot of the president with his dog on the lawn at the White House. And we're thinking, think of all those man hours that we could take and use on original reporting. Original reporting is what is going to save and distinguish us. Original ideas and continuing to bring to probe the horizon, continuing to cross beyond what people are seeing into what they're not seeing. And that is a conversation among a lot of people. So I think both things can operate at work, and we can make those distinctions. I really do.
So,
yes.
Once you kind of leave the anchor desk at someday, maybe, how do you want to be remembered?
I never think about it. It's not what I think about at the end of the day. I started out not expecting to get in this job. I started out thinking that I would tell stories of some kind. I didn't know where. A friend of mine said to me once, okay, you've got a story of a college kid who comes home to a really dysfunctional family and then ends up isolated from everybody else. And you tell it one way it's Hamlet, tell it the other way it's Gilligan's Island. And you have to choose. And I thought, I don't want to choose. I want to be able to live inside the stories, wherever they take me. And I believe that careers are best when you're in a river that is carrying you forward. And it is the river of what you authentically care about and believe. And at the end of the day, it doesn't matter to me what is said or is written, except that the people I worked with feel it was time they were happy to spend. And that at the end of the day, maybe a few lives were changed and we nudged the world in the direction of generosity and goodness. That's it.
Well, you know, unfortunately, you know, it's time for you. You've got the exciting newscast to.
I have to do that today. I'm going to stand on your roof.
Good job. Well, you know, it's been really a tremendous honor to sit amongst you today. Such a respected and admirable journalist, somebody I look up to for the last 21 years. So, oh my goodness, I'm getting sad. So thank you so much, and thank you for coming here, hanging out with us at West for a few days, and thank you for leaving your mark on the journalism industry forever and impacting really all of our lives here today. And, you know, we all want to say thank you and congratulations, and we really are glad you came out here. And thank you.
And I just want to say to all of you who are supporting the Cronkite School in all of your myriad and wonderful ways, and to Dean Callahan, it is a beacon to come here and see what you're doing, what you care about, and to all of the people who in this community still believe in the great glory and importance of the news, I salute you. My reward is getting to meet you and rededicate all of us together.
Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, on behalf of ASU President Michael Crow, Cronkite School Dean Christopher Callahan, and the Walter Cronkite Endowment Board of Trustees, thank you for attending the 27th Annual Walter Cronkite Award for Excellence in Journalism Luncheon.
Thank you again.